Thursday. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we kick off our series of candidate interviews for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. First, as the nation experiences the public health emergency economic recession caused by COVID-19, it may sometimes feel like we're facing unprecedented challenges. At the same time, the Black Lives Matter movement and protests against systemic racism have spurred a national reckoning and demands for action. Our next guests are historians. They join us for a look at how the nation and past presidents responded to social movements in past moments of crisis. We'll zoom in on two eras in American history, the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt that took place during the Great Depression and World War II, and President Lyndon Johnson, who signed historic civil rights legislation while the U.S. fought in the Vietnam War. Catherine Oberdeck is an associate professor of history at the University of Illinois. She's an expert in 19th and 20th century United States cultural working class history. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And John Cooper is an emeritus professor of history at UW-Madison. His expertise is in political history, race and reform, and presidential reputations in the 20th century. John, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, Catherine, can you talk about how national crises, big ones maybe like we face today, have coincided with, maybe led to advances in social movements in the past?
Well, starting thinking about FDR's presidency, one of the ones that you brought up, this did coincide with a jump in involvement in the labor movement in the 1930s that really kind of shaped the initiatives that FDR took during that period. So initially, he got a lot of kind of economic stimulus initiatives going, especially in his first 100 days. Principally the National Industrial Recovery Act, which also had a section, Section 7A, that provided federal support for the first time to the right to organize unions. And this galvanized a lot of organizers and grassroots workers around the country who were anxious to take hold over organizations of their own that through which they could obtain better economic security. And so those two things together, particularly as the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations that focused on industrial workers in mass industries like auto, steel, rubber making, meat packing, began new efforts to organize workers in those industries. That really helped to create a constituency that in turn helped to push further some of the legislation that FDR undertook that might not have been gone as far as it would have had that labor movement not been around. So things like the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 and later on the facilitation of Social Security, wider unemployment relief, and even public housing initiatives.
And John, how much did this moment of crisis allow FDR and his administration to experiment, to try a lot of new stuff that they might not have had the latitude to do without this crisis mentality?
Well, it gave him great latitude, maybe not unlimited, but I think FDR had the closest thing to a blank check from Congress that any president has ever had. I mean, you had... The Great Depression was our greatest national crisis and emergency since the Civil War. It affected the country as much, and in some ways, it was even more nationwide than the Civil War was. FDR came in. I mean, the one thing that's interesting is FDR didn't so much win the 1932 election as Herbert Hoover lost. It was, more than anything else, the 32 election was a referendum on Herbert Hoover and voting him out. FDR really was all over the map in some ways about what he was proposing. He didn't have a very specific agenda. It was very clear that he was going to use the powers of government a lot more than Hoover had. Hoover had really painted himself into a corner on what the government could not do, so that FDR had that latitude. And as you were saying, he tried different things. I mean, the initial thing, the first 100 days, 1933, was aimed at various kinds of recovery, industrial recovery, agricultural recovery, financial recovery. It was really oriented toward recovery. What they called the Second New Deal in 1935 was much more toward various kinds of economic and social reform. One other thing, the organized labor movement was not the only social movement going on. There were a bunch of different ones. There were kind of the trinity, as they called them, of the, demagogues. Some people call them demagogues. Others call them social conscience rousers. I mean, there was Father Coughlin, the radio priest, kind of showing the power of a new medium. There was Dr. Townsend, who led what they call the Old Folks Crusade, which was aimed at pensions for retirement. And that had an impact, very much an impact on shaping Social Security. And then, of course, there was the most powerful one of them all, Senator Huey Long, who was the virtual dictator of Louisiana and had a nationwide movement called Share Our Wealth. And FDR was genuinely afraid of Huey Long. Fortunately for FDR, Huey Long was assassinated in 1935, so there's no telling what kind of impact he might have had on the 1936 election.
We're talking to historians Catherine Oberdeck and John Cooper about past moments of crisis in American history and some of the social reforms that came out of them. Well, that was a whirlwind tour of FDR and the New Deal. I want to spend a little time now in the 1960s under President Lyndon Johnson. We have social movements, the civil rights movement. It didn't start in the 60s, of course, but really reaching a peak in some ways, and the Vietnam War escalating as a concern for Americans. Catherine, with civil rights in particular, what do you see? How did you see social movements translate into policy changes?
Well, of course, and as you said, the civil rights efforts have been going on for a long time, and there were immediately before the 1960s, the Brown v. Topeka Board of Education Supreme Court decision desegregating schools, or aiming to, as well as the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 and 1956. These really kind of, piqued interest among longtime African-American organizers about the possibilities of civil rights organization. And of course, the Montgomery bus boycott brought into the public realm the, at that time, very young minister, Martin Luther King Jr., who became really a mobilizer for that movement, but mobilizing a community organization that already existed, that people like Rosa Parks was already part of when it began. So many of the people who organized civil rights activism in the 1960s, at the time that LBJ became president, they were looking to those changes and those movements as opportunities and models for change. And this was particularly true of the young activists of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that kind of got started with lunch counter sit-ins of the 1960s, moved into the Freedom Rides of 1960 and 61, aiming to desegregate public transportation, something that recently passed Representative John Lewis was very much involved in, and then moved on into really community-oriented both voting rights and desegregation struggles throughout the South, where they drew on those kinds of models of that things like the bus boycott had provided. And they also found themselves fighting against the fierce resistance of Southern segregationists who met them with fierce police retaliation as well as violence on the part of the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations. So all of that really then kind of pressed both Kennedy, but Kennedy was somewhat less willing to kind of mobilize the political kinds of navigation that you would need to do to get legislation through. He finally, in 1963, in the wake of an ongoing struggle in Birmingham, Alabama, proposed a civil rights bill. It did not get out into a vote in Congress until after he was assassinated. And LBJ, who was really a master navigator of political horse trading in Congress, helped to navigate it through immediately after it, seen the JFK's assassination, seen it as a kind of way of a eulogy for Kennedy's death. And so that was the first big civil rights bill that comes through in the 1960s. It mainly focuses on issues of desegregation and doesn't really address some things that civil rights activists were increasingly concerned about, like police brutality or even voting rights. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, coming on the heels of the Selma to Montgomery March, which both Reverend King and Representative Lewis were very involved in, helped and to catalyze that.
We need to take a break in just a couple of moments. I'm sorry to cut in, Catherine. John, I want to get your take on Johnson through this period that Catherine is just talking about, navigating twin crises, the civil rights movements that and the policies that fall short, as Catherine was saying, as the Vietnam War escalated.
Well, LBJ, Doris Kearns Goodwin, in her memoir of LBJ, noted that whenever it came to domestic politics and domestic things, LBJ was, what can I do? You know, what can I achieve? I mean, he was driving forward, and he very much wanted to fulfill and push the New Deal forward. I mean, he got his political start under Franklin Roosevelt. But when it came to foreign affairs, it was, how can I avoid mistakes? So you really have a political split personality there. Johnson had, as Catherine said, he was a master of weaving through these different different factions and positions in the Democratic Party, and he had he'd already pushed through. It's seen as it's somewhat poo-pooed now, the Civil Rights Act of 1957, as being a token or a gesture. The point was, this was the first civil rights bill that had ever gotten passed, and he had beaten back the Southern filibuster. LBJ, in many ways, was something Kennedy wasn't. Kennedy was not racist, but he really wasn't very concerned with race. Interestingly, Lyndon Johnson, deep down underneath that, and he certainly could play the Southern game and talk the Southern talk, but underneath that, this was a man who really cared about the poor and the downtrodden and the people who were discriminated against. I mean, the first evidence of that was when he had to drop out of college for a year and work as a principal for a school down in Cotulla, Texas. He cared about those Mexican students, those Mexican kids, in ways that nobody had ever done. And so there was always that in him, and he was ready to do this. He really wanted to do it, and yes, indeed, he did capitalize on this mood of national grief and atonement and make it up to Kennedy, and you know, he seized upon that, and then once he'd won re-election or election in 64, he really took the bit between his teeth. By the way, one thing that I really did not like in that movie Selma, which I think is a very fine film, is that its portrayal of Lyndon Johnson as a reluctant champion of civil rights simply is wrong. It's just wrong. He and Martin Luther King, in many ways, were playing using different tactics and different fronts to advance this. The most moving presidential speech I've ever heard was the speech that he gave right after the affair in Selma, where he ended it with an unscripted line at the end. You know, he talked about what this would do, and he said, "And we shall overcome." I mean, that was really powerful.
We're talking to historians Catherine Oberdeck and John Cooper right now about moments in American history, twin crises in American history that could shed some light on the present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you look to history to make sense of our current moment? What comparisons do you see? Lessons can we learn? What questions do you have about previous social movements here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with historians Catherine Oberdeck and John Cooper. We're taking a look back at past eras of American history in the 20th century, big crises in the times of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, and maybe lessons in leadership for today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on ways that social movements of the past during past American crises led to changes, lessons maybe learned from them for today? Join in at 800-642-1234. I want to ask each of you maybe a bit of a lightning round. Is there a lesson from past presidential leadership in these two periods we're talking about, or maybe others, that could be guidance for a President Trump today in his second term, or a term of President Joe Biden if he should win the election? Catherine, let's start with you.
That's a good question. I think one thing that we saw during the periods that we've been talking about today that we don't see right now is a kind of interconnection between social movements, bipartisan legislative efforts, and a president kind of interested in addressing a number of different crises. So really kind of listening to those voices and also getting past the nearly decade-long absence of bipartisan legislative efforts, I think, would be helpful in terms of addressing the kinds of really important health, economic, and racial justice issues that we see raised right now.
Interesting. And John, how about you?
Well, I think the only one of the candidates this fall who can and will learn lessons from the past is Biden. I won't even go into Donald Trump. He's not. There was a phrase that Talleyrand said about the Bourbons: they learned nothing and forgot nothing. And I think that has applications today. Biden has the opportunity to be another FDR, because if he wins, it'll be because people are voting Trump out. So he'll be, in a sense, in the same situation. And of course, with multiple crises and multiple problems like that. He also, though, I think without the overbearing qualities, he's a lot like LBJ, because LBJ spent his entire adult life on Capitol Hill, and so has Joe Biden. I mean, the only time he has not been on Capitol Hill, well, he was also in the White House when he was vice president, but this man knows that. The difference is with both FDR and LBJ, you had an opposition party which was giving him a lot of slack. The Civil Rights Act of acts of the 1960s were passed on with bipartisan majorities. I mean, the division was within the Democratic Party. It was the white Southern Democrats, and then some had crossed over. Strom Thurmond had crossed over to the Republican Party, but that it was very much bipartisan. And back in the New Deal days, the Republicans were just plain on the run, and they didn't know how to oppose FDR. And really, it's not until he had faltered in his second term, and then the whole venue of politics was changed, very very much like LBJ to foreign affairs, and then that became another kind of battleground, and you had a revived partisanship there, a revived polarization.
And Catherine, I wanted to talk a little bit about our historical memory. A lot of people look back at the lunch counter sit-ins and things like that, and look at those as a very positive, effective form of protest, and compare negatively sometimes modern protest with that. There's a Gallup poll from the early 60s going on showing a majority of Americans disapproving, saying these protests would actually hurt the efforts toward racial justice. We kind of forget, I think, what people thought of these things at the time. Can you talk about that a little?
There were certainly varied perspectives on very different kinds of strategies over time, and the civil rights activists of the 1960s garnered an enormous amount of, as I've suggested, resistance, particularly in the communities where they were working. But I think the other, particularly kind of thinking about for today and the way that today's movements maybe look back and learn from those, there's kind of an interesting controversy within among historians of the African American past about is there one long movement, or are there many different movements with different strategies? And I think we really need to look to those different strategies, some of the ways in which the very legislation as movements we've been talking about have changed the ground. And what I find very exciting personally about the current movements is, in my town anyway, the education that they're doing, the efforts that particularly young people are making to kind of connect different constituencies up together and think about how the demands that they're making and developing relate to a variety of social issues around not only race, but economic conditions, gender, sexuality, et cetera. That's very exciting.
We have just a minute left, John. Can you give us a brief pep talk about the value of looking to our history for lessons for today?
Where else do we have to look? We have to. And in terms of following up on what Catherine said, presidents basically don't like agitation. You know, it creates problems for them. Of the three we're talking about, FDR, Kennedy, and Johnson, Johnson's the only one who really, I think, had a sense of how to use it. I mean, FDR, with the labor movement, at one point, when they had the sit-down strikes in 1937, he said, a plague of both your houses. So presidents respond in different ways. And they usually see agitators, dissenting movements, as protest movements, as troublemakers. And sometimes, some of them, I think LBJ is the model for someone who saw this as useful troublemaking. Of course, Vietnam was a completely different story.
Oh, the time flew by. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Welcome.
And Catherine, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Catherine Oberdeck is an associate professor of history at the University of Illinois. John Cooper is an emeritus professor of history at UW-Madison. They talked to us today about social movements in American history and the policy changes that they led to. Coming up after the news, we kick off a series of candidate interviews in this year's congressional primaries here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Between now and next month's primary elections, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates running in contested primaries for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and the Morning Show. You'll be able to find all these interviews at WPR.org/politics. Starting things off, earlier today we talked to Representative Ron Kind of La Crosse. He's held the seat for Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district since 1997 and is running for re-election in the August Democratic primary. The 3rd District spans parts of 18 counties in central and western Wisconsin. Also in that race, Democrat Mark Newman, who we'll talk to in just a bit today, and Republicans Derek Van Orden and Jesse Ebbin. We'll talk to them later this week. Representative Kind, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
Well, first of all, can you make your basic case for your reelection to Congress?
Yeah, you know, it's easy. I was born and raised in western Wisconsin, raised my family there. I know the area. I know the challenges, the goals of the district, and people have gotten a chance to know me too throughout the years. They know I'm a hard worker, very pragmatic, very accessible to them, and a good listener. And I'm also very proud by the fact that annually groups always recognize me as one of the most bipartisan members of the U.S. Congress. Willingness to reach across the aisle, work with my colleagues on the other side, be respectful, and find common ground to get things done. And because of that, I'm one of the most effective legislators in Congress, too. And I think that's what the people of Wisconsin want in their representatives. We need more of that in Washington. We need more of it in Madison and at the local level, because things are just too polarized and too hyperpartisan. But I know there's a way of getting things done, and people and groups recognize it.
Well, now, what you said might be a selling point to some, but in both parties, there are constituents who say, no, we don't send you there to compromise. We want you to fight for beliefs on our side. What would you say to that wing on the Democratic side of things? How are you meeting their needs?
Well, I am a Democrat, first and foremost, and I am a principled person, too. And there are certain things that I believe very strongly in. But it doesn't mean you need to engage in the hyper-partisanship and just paralyze the place either. I think the people want to see you get some results. They want us to work together and be respectful to one another. It's the Wisconsin way. It's how things get done back home. And I think they expect that in the representatives in Washington, too. But unfortunately, it's just not the case. Too many people come to their position with a my way or no way at all attitude. That's a recipe for disaster and not getting things done. So I realize that there are strong feelings on both sides. But listen, if I'm not taking incoming from the far left and the far right, I'm probably not representing my district very well.
What do you see as some of the most pressing issues right now facing the 3rd District and your constituents there?
Well, first of all, we got to keep people healthy and safe with this coronavirus. This is an all hands on deck moment, and we need to get on the same page. You know, wearing facial covering should not be a political controversy. I never viewed that as a red issue or a blue issue. I've always viewed it as a red, white, and blue issue, something we all need to do to protect one another as we buy time until we develop a vaccine to keep people safe ultimately. And beyond that, I think rising healthcare costs, making sure that everyone has access to affordable quality healthcare. That's very apparent during a pandemic like this, but this is something that we need to continue to focus on. I'm proud of my leadership on healthcare issues, trying to change the way we pay for healthcare so it's based on the quality or the outcome of care that's given and no longer the volume of services. I think that's the best way to drive down costs while increasing the quality of care. We have a huge digital divide. I've been appointed to a national broadband task force to close that digital divide and the economic and education inequities that flow from it, especially in rural Wisconsin. We just passed legislation a couple of weeks ago that has a major investment in rural broadband expansion, the largest in our nation's history. We've got to close that gap to make sure that opportunity is available for all Americans wherever they might be. And then finally, Rob, given the district I have, one of the larger agriculture-producing districts in the nation, the family farmers have never had a stronger champion on their side in Congress than myself. I've gone to bat for them during the virus and even before that with chronically low commodity prices to level the playing field for them, doing everything in our power to make sure they get a good price for the hard work that they do put in so they can pay their bills and keep these operations going. So, now, some of the key issues, certainly, for my congressional district.
We're talking to Representative Ron Kind, incumbent in the race for Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district this year. Representative Kind, big conversation surrounding Black Lives Matter-related protests and calls for police reform. Are there reforms to American policing that you are pushing for or would push for in Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. I think George Floyd has opened up a lot of hearts and minds and eyes throughout the country. And we all need to be elevating our game when it comes to race relations and make sure that the promise of America, that all people are created equal, is in fact kept in our society. But as a former special prosecutor in Wisconsin, too, I've worked with law enforcement. I've seen the good work that they do. And yet I encourage them and all of us to run towards the criticism. Don't be afraid to find out what the problems are and how best we can address it. We need a strong, trustful law enforcement relationship with the community. We all need to be striving for that goal. That's why I passed the police reform legislation when it came before us a couple of weeks ago. I've been working hard on a special provision that would increase resources for implicit bias training, something that many of our law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin partake in already, and they are very high in the recommendation that we need to be doing more of that. These are some of the things that we have to address. But I've been doing a lot of outreach in our communities with the demonstrators too, listening to them, what their desires are and what we can accomplish by working together. Unfortunately, during the political season, there'll be some people that will try to weaponize this politically to drive us apart, to divide the communities. That's not the type of leadership that we need right now.
There's been talk about maybe more infrastructure spending in the United States over the last bunch of years, really, and it's been talked about as one possible measure for economic relief during the coronavirus and its economic fallout. Do you have a vision for infrastructure programs you'd like to pursue?
Yeah, I do. In fact, just 2 weeks ago in the House of Representatives, we passed the largest infrastructure reinvestment bill in the last 15 years, the Move American Forward Act. Obviously, there will be resources in it to rebuild our roads, our highways, our bridges, airports, ports, things that we need to do to lay the groundwork for long-term economic growth, along with the good paying jobs that will come from it, just as we're emerging from the virus and trying to rebuild Wisconsin, rebuild America again. But also included, and it was a provision that I worked on, for more resources on flood mitigation planning. In Wisconsin, as in a lot of parts of the country, we're getting perennial flooding. Think the Kickapoo and Lafarge Valley area of my district. And we need to be more forward-looking in our planning, creating strong partnerships at the federal, state, and local level to address these hard-hit communities. Also in it are production tax credits for the development of alternative and renewable energy sources, recognizing the existential threat of climate change and the action we need to take. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, a major chapter for investment in broadband expansion. So regardless where you are, where you live, you're going to have access to high-speed internet connection. This is important for distance learning, as we found out in the spring. It's important for telehealth, and we're just scratching the surface on the potential of telehealth practice to drive down costs and improve the quality. And it's important to sustain rural communities for job investment and for our production agriculture. So that was in the legislation. We're hoping the Senate and the administration will work with us on it. I couldn't think of a better time to start moving forward and rebuilding America than coming out of this crisis right now.
And finally, there's been a lot of investment with the CARES Act and other programs, a lot of money being put into economic relief here in the United States. How do you balance that and possible future spending against concerns of borrowing and a big jump in an already pretty big federal debt?
Yeah, Rob, as you know, I've been one of the most fiscally conservative members of Congress since I got here. I believe in pay-as-you-go budgeting rules. It's a simple rule that says if you're going to offer a tax cut or a spending increase, you got to find an offset to pay for it. We should have been doing that before this pandemic hit us. But at a crisis like this, we need to do what we can to minimize the economic damage. But I'm also part of a working group, a bipartisan group right now, looking at long-term fix to our fiscal house. And we need to start thinking about that and what that will look like, while also making crucial investments to make sure that we succeed as a country. And other areas, too, that we should be addressing policy-wise, family and medical leave policy, child care. You know, these things have come to light because of the coronavirus as well. And these are things we need to start moving on in order to prepare for a long strength economy once we develop a vaccine to inoculate people to keep them safe.
Representative Kine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. My pleasure.
Ron Kine is a Democrat running for re-election to represent Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. We talked with him earlier today. Coming up, we'll hear from the other Democrat facing Kine in the August primary, Mark Newman. Later in the week, we'll talk to the Republicans on that side of the primary, Derek Van Norden and Jesse Eben. Part of our ongoing series of candidate interviews for the August primary. Find them all at WPR.org/politics. Also, WPR will air a live debate between Republican primary candidates at 10 a.m. on Friday, July 31st, Democrats on 10 a.m. Thursday, August 6th. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the state is piloting a new confidential counseling hotline for farmers experiencing stress and mental health concerns. We'll talk to the director of that program to learn more about the resource and its goals. First, between now and next month's primary election, WPR has invited candidates running in contested races for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of these interviews at WPR.org/politics. Dr. Mark Newman of La Crosse joins us now. He's a Democrat challenging incumbent Ron Kind to represent Wisconsin's 3rd District in Congress. Not to be confused, by the way, with former Republican Congressman Mark Newman. We talked to Representative Kind earlier in the program. Also in the race, Republicans Derek Van Orden and Jesse Eben will talk to them later this week. Dr. Newman was a pediatrician for more than 3 decades. He also served as a Franciscan brother for 20 years. Dr. Newman, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start with your basic pitch to voters. Why do you want their vote to represent Wisconsin's 3rd District?
You know, I have been devoting my life since I've retired to engagement, better engagement, stronger engagement in our political arena. It's important to me that we do all we can to make our democracy work. And I'm particularly concerned that we address the issues of payment for our healthcare services, and also a solid response to the need for leadership in addressing global climate change. I have noticed when I go to the polls that sometimes I am not given a choice. Many times there could be elected officials who are listed as candidates and they stand alone. And that's always felt a little unusual and almost like I was being deprived of really participating in my democratic process. So I wanted to this year offer a second choice on our August 11 fall primary. I know that Congressman Kind has only seen other candidates on his ballot two times since 2000. And I think that undermines our ability to have a good lead up to an election because we need to talk about the issues that are important to us. And so I wanted to offer the people of Western Wisconsin this opportunity this year.
As a Democrat challenging an incumbent Democrat, how would you distinguish yourself? What kind of issues would set you apart?
You know, I think there's a really big distinction between myself and Congressman Kind. He is a very accomplished politician, and he is adapted, I think, well to what is going on in Washington, D.C. But when you look at our citizens' appreciation of the work of the Congress, it usually comes in around 20% approval, 20 to 25, as Gallup polls and other polls have shown their work over the last couple of decades. And because of this, it means that there's something seems to be missing. And over the last decades, we've also had an issue with more and more money involved in our electoral process. Our elected officials feel that they have to mount robust campaigns that tend to be hyper-marketed enterprises, and they depend upon people and PACs and groups that have a lot of resources available to finance those campaigns. And I think that that doesn't allow the voice of the small people to be recognized. It offers those with money and power an opportunity to have megaphone influence in the electoral process. And then our elected officials need to prepare for the next round of election and to gather more finances, financial resources for the next election. I have determined that I will never involve myself in that activity because I believe that the people that I would need to respond to are the simple voters. And all voters are not things. The votes are not things. The votes are people, people with dreams and hopes and worries and concerns. And those worries and concerns get expressed by their voice, and their voice gets carried to their vote at election time. And that's what we need to listen to and elevate during our campaign season instead of being barraged by glitzy and sometimes scary campaign advertising.
Talking to Dr. Mark Newman, running in the Democratic primary for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District against incumbent Ron Kind. Dr. Newman, I want to get your take on a few of the big issues you would face if you're in Congress. First of all, you've mentioned health care. What particular policies would you like to see?
Over the decades, people have asked me whether or not we're ever going to be able to have a universal healthcare availability in our country. And I've always felt like, yes, we certainly would. And people have asked me, well, how can you be so certain? And my answer is because other developed economies have been able to solve this problem. And unfortunately, given the history of our country, we've attempted 6 times to develop a universal healthcare payment system over the last 100 years. And we've always been beat back by special interests because when people are sick and desperate and very concerned, they become vulnerable as targets for profit making. And our current system allows that to carry on. We have many special interests involved in our current healthcare payment system that don't want to be left out. They don't want to have to leave. And ultimately, that is the solution. So that a legislation like H.R. 1384 that was introduced by Pramila Jayapal, the congresswoman from Seattle, Washington, solves this problem. And it provides for a health insurance plan that is similar to, but better than, what the Canadians have. The big thing that's different about what she proposes, and it happens to be called Medicare for All 2019, but what she proposes and what we're living with today is that when they were developing this legislation, they did not resort to having the insurance companies at the table because they're not contributing to our healthcare, but they're certainly getting in the way of developing an economical and egalitarian delivery system.
Then I want to get your thoughts on the federal government response to COVID-19. Hopefully, we would be past it by the time of the next congressional term. But looking at what you see right now, what else would you like to see at the federal level?
You know, I am very admiring of local leadership. You know, certainly what I experience in Wisconsin, in La Crosse County and so forth, we have very devoted public servants who are doing their darndest to provide good guidance and care for their populations. But what we're missing is, as you just alluded to, federal leadership. The Congress, as from what I can tell from a distance, appears to be doing its darndest to provide resources. But when we have an executive branch that has dropped the ball so miserably, it becomes impossible for us to have that guidance that our local leaders need in order to provide for the specific needs of each region. Our country is vast, and so one plan isn't going to fit everywhere, or the application of one plan isn't going to fit everywhere the same at every time. But we do need a coordination of efforts, and we need the development of best practices, and we need to have these things shared, which the federal government could provide and should provide by the structure of our governance.
Another big issue today, protests for racial justice and concerns about policing. Are there specific police reforms that you would support in Congress?
Yes, I think the basic one, the deepest one is, and this dates back 50 years, and that was the appearance of the American War on Drugs. That was an invention under the Nixon administration that has distorted our policing in more and more and worse over the years. And until we can really recognize how injurious that policy that has been with us for half a century is to all Americans and to contributing to mass incarceration and to the militarization of our community police, we're going to have a hard time addressing the real issues that are very aggravating and of very much concern that we see in the demonstrations that have happened over the last 50 days since the criminal death of Mr. George Floyd. So I see a large picture answer to this specific problem. It isn't just an easy answer of moving some financial resources around, but we really do have to dig deeper into what we have imposed upon our community police, given this history, so that instead of being able to devote themselves to the safety and security of their local populations, they end up being brought into this crazy war on drugs. When we tried to eliminate alcohol in the early 20th century, you know, it didn't work. And so it took a while for that amendment to the Constitution to be revoked. But we're still living with this horrible legacy of a misplaced strategy that was started by President Nixon, probably for political reasons.
Very briefly, just in our last few moments, do you have thoughts on your ability to work across the aisle with Republicans if you were elected?
Absolutely. You know, I have never found in my soul an ability to engage in us against them strategizing. I think that it undermines our ability as humans to do what we really need. We want to come together to create a governance that allows for us to thrive and all of our neighbors to thrive and not just to survive. But when we engage in an us against them, winner take all, zero sum approach to decision making, battles are never won or lost. They're just moved. So what we need to do is to move beyond that form of trying to develop public policy and to truly engage in consensus arrival. After the Civil War, President Lincoln proposed that we need to appeal to our better angels in order to enter into Reconstruction. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to guide us at that time in our American history.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks to Dr. Mark Newman, running as a Democrat to represent Wisconsin's 3rd District in Congress. We heard from Representative Ron Kind, the Democratic incumbent. We'll hear from the Republicans on their side of the primary later this week here on Central Time. Looking for a new house? How about the house that the Golden Girls lived in? It's for sale, sort of. The TV show took place in Miami, but for the exterior of the house that they lived in, producers used a house in Los Angeles. Now, that house is for sale for just shy of $3 million. Cheesecake not included, as far as I can tell on the listing. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson is a big fan of the show. Hey, Judith.
Hey, Rob.
So you've got $3 million lying around, I assume. So you're going to be bidding on this house?
Well, you know, I haven't been spending a lot, you know, going out and stuff during COVID. So I figure I could scrape it together. You know, I know that it's only the exterior, but still there's something about the house. And I have to say, I have rather recently gotten kind of into mid-mod architecture, and that certainly fits. So there's that attraction. There are those gorgeous ferns in front. And I like to think, even though you never really see it, it's probably part of the set, I like to think that it comes with the lanai that they spend so much time on.
And you're a big fan, I mentioned,
I
of the show.
I am.
What is it about the Golden Girls?
I just, you know, they were talking about things in the 80s that no one else was talking about. It was four strong women supporting each other, living alone. It was really pretty groundbreaking back in the day. And, you know, it was really well written. I can watch the Golden Girls any day.
All right. Thank you for being my boss, Judith.
Thanks for being my host, Rob.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.